Magic,
and the magic, world of illusion.
Magic TV
and Craig Petty proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It's 9 o'clock, which means it's time for another video. And today I'm back with an interview with somebody who is taking the magic world by storm. Just in the last year alone, he's brought out best-selling tricks with Saturn Magic, 1914, Alakazam. He's going to be working with a bunch of other companies going forward. His creativity is through the roof. He's also an incredible performer, and I cannot wait to find out more about him and his story and magic. I am, of course, talking about Mr. Transaction himself, the one and only Paul Fowler. How are you doing, Paul?
Craig, I'm good, mate. Thank you so much for having me back on here. And yeah, excited to talk to you some more about the crazy world of magic.
Dude, I'm really excited to find out more about you, because obviously I've become a big fan watching a lot of your stuff that's coming out recently. And one thing that I've noticed, and we'll talk about this later on, but one thing I've noticed is you seem to have an uncanny ability to create everyday carry style magic and mentalism. Like, you look at the stuff that's come out recently, it's using credit cards, it's using receipts, it's using socks, it's stuff that you actually would imagine that you have. It's not like you're bringing out a special 3D printed doodad that looks like nothing on Green's Earth. It's organic. And you know, I think that's one of the reasons you're making such a big name for yourself.
Yeah, it's, I guess when I've been, you know, gigging as a magician all these years, I always felt that there was a kind of a bit missing with, you know, EDC magic. Not so much now, but, you know, looking back sort of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, there were, you know, great tricks for when you're gigging, but there was a gap where I thought that, you know, I could create some magic for myself predominantly. And then, and yeah, it just happened, some of these ideas have you know, been very popular with other magicians. And I guess I just think like that. I know you do as well. I just sort of look at what I carry day to day and look at what I would like to see if I was watching a magician, and what would make it more believable for me. You know, everyday things like, you know, credit cards, receipts, and that would you know, definitely hook me in. And that's why I do it, I guess.
Amazing. Well, I'm going to talk more about your creative process in a bit. But first of all, for people who don't know who you are, and I can't imagine there's many people who don't know who you are with like the notoriety you've made for yourself in the last year. But for anyone who doesn't know who Paul Fowler is, I want to talk a little bit about your journey into magic. And I want to start at the very beginning. I want to talk about your origin story, Paul. So I want to know how you got into magic. Now, where and when did this happen? What did it look like?
Okay, so it's not really the stereotypical story of, like, you know, getting a magic kit when you're younger. Yes, I did have that. I'd like some Paul Daniels set, but I remember getting it and it was too difficult for me to actually do anything with, because it was like these balls and all sorts of things. I couldn't do anything. So I played around with some magic. There was a little set you could buy from the local news agents that had like a little thumb tip, you know, vanishing the silk and that type of thing, and the coin where you have the bands round and that sort of thing, and a little die in the tube. I did those at school and, you know, didn't really think anything of it. It was really David Blaine that got me into it properly. I remember being, I don't know, maybe like 13 or 14, I was about to go to school, and my mum sort of woke me up in the morning, as she probably always did back then, because I didn't have an alarm clock or I didn't have any responsibility. So my mum woke me up and went, yeah, you got to see this guy. And I was like, what do you mean? It's like this guy David Blaine. So I come downstairs and it was I think it was his first Street Magic special. It might have been, I don't know, Magic Man, I think was his second one, the one where he was going like around the rainforest. I can't remember, but I remember I was thinking, oh yeah, what's all this about? And then he did the trick where he asked you to think of number between 1 and 50, both odd digits, and I was like, out loud, went, oh yeah, 37. And he literally said 37, and I just went, okay, how is that possible? So I was kind of really hooked on that. But At that stage, I assumed that, like everyone else did, that there was this mythical ability that he had, that he wasn't like a human being. And I thought, oh, it can't be possible. A human being has got to be able to learn that. So I, when the internet was, you know, much more in its prime, I sort of Googled it, and it was very hard to find, but I found, you know, early shops like magictricks.co.uk and some information, and really just started learning some stuff for myself. Didn't have any confidence going to do it, but I was starting at things like ambitious cards straight away. So I didn't have any fundamentals of the sleight of hand. I was just wanting to do the stuff Blaine was doing. And I kept that to myself really all for the rest of school, from maybe like my year nine till when I left. And started to get more into it and introduce things like Invisible Deck and that sort of thing. And then went to college, and that was the first time I actually started to go and do it in like the canteen, the cafeteria at lunchtime, and got known as the guy doing some card tricks. And that was that first experience where you start getting reactions and people think you're cool because you're doing magic. Or at least I thought they did. You know, maybe they didn't. Maybe they thought I was a bit of a weirdo, but who knows? You know, maybe they were thinking, I just want to eat my burger and chips, leave me alone, which is quite possible, but they seemed to enjoy it. And I was just doing the same four or five tricks over and over again, which is a coincidence, because that's technically my act now as well, doing the same four or five tricks over and again until I get bored. So I was doing like the same four or five tricks over and over again. And then eventually ran out of material. And I didn't fall out of love with it. I just lost interest in it, because I was getting to the point where I was like 18 years old. I started to get into, you know, going out with your mates, going down the gym, getting into women and those sorts of things, and completely forgot about it, really. Not forgot about it. It was always there, but I lost a bit of interest in it and became one of those. Sometimes you meet them at gigs, don't you, or out in public, where they go, oh yeah, I've done magic before, I know how it works, and they're kind of jaded by the fact that they're not magicians anymore, but they think they know it all. And I kind of was one of those for a little while, because I wasn't practicing magic anymore. And I was with my girlfriend, who is now my wife, and it was our first family trip to Florida, probably when I was about, it would have been when I was about 19, and I'm 37 now, so 37 this year. I was 19 at the time, and there was this place, I'm not sure it's still there, it was called Wonderworks, and it was on International Drive, and I think it was like a lopsided hat like building, and you could go in, and it was like an interesting place, a bit like Ripley's, that sort of thing. But they had a dinner show in the evening with a magician, and at the time I was going through a bit of a difficult time in work, where I was in a bit of a dead-end job. I was an engineer at the time, and I was earning a salary, but my mates were earning more than me, and I wanted to essentially have a sideline and something to essentially give myself more money to be able to do the things that, you know, they were all doing. And I was on the lookout for that. And when I saw this show at Wonderworks, and I don't know who the magician is, but if somebody does listen to this and knows who the magician is, it would have been around the year kind of 2002, three, something like that. Maybe even 2008. I don't know. So around that time, a magician, he was doing a dinner show at Wonderworks. He was doing a show, and we went to it, and it was absolutely brilliant. And I still knew kind of how things are being done, like he was doing Billy and Lemon and Thumb Tie Escape and stuff like that. But it was the first time I've really seen it done in a cabaret scenario, and I absolutely loved it. And I looked at my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and I went, that's it. And she went, what do you mean? I went, well, I used to do some magic. I reckon I could get back into this and have some fun. I was all right. I could, and if I get good enough, I could go and earn a little bit of money doing it. And she was like, yeah, whatever. She never seen me do anything. Haven't seen me do any magic before whatsoever. She thought I was probably just drunk, so I probably was. But yeah. And then before we even got back from that holiday, I actually did some Googling, and I found a local club to where I lived at the time called Medway Magic Society. And I literally contacted them and said, I've got an interest in magic. Can I come in? And I think within a few days of me getting back, I went to the first meeting, and I remember, because I remember getting out of the car, and the first person I met was Henry White. And me and Henry became, Henry was, you know, I don't know, quite young then. He was probably like at school, but he was sort of in his blazer and he was going around doing card tricks and that. And over the years, we got to know each other and became quite good friends. And that kind of stemmed on. I just became a member of that Magic Society, learned some stuff, and then I started gigging and earning a little bit of money on the side, and it was brilliant. But I wanted more. I was like, how can I, you know, push this further? I love what I'm doing now. I kind of felt like I'd found my calling, because I didn't really like the job I was doing. I was an engineer, and I'd had various different engineer jobs, like electrician, fire alarms, that sort of thing. But I realized magic, and I'd always been into entertaining and the performing arts when I was a kid. So it kind of, it fit really well. And then I met a magician at the club called Spencer Wood, who is a very, very well-known magician on the circuit. You know, he has been for a very long time. And weirdly, I was creating some really bad magic at the time, and I showed him some stuff, and he went, that's really cool, mate. And he goes, why don't you know, you know, come and hang around at my offices, and we'll work on some tricks, you know, jam and that sort of thing. And we did, and we became very good friends. And it got to a point where he sort of took me under his wing for a while and sort of taught me the business side of magic. And very quickly, you know, I was doing very, very high profile gigs because of that. But I wanted more. So I wanted to learn how to sell myself as a magician, but I couldn't do that within the day job I had. So I sort of blagged my way into a sales job. I left a very, very secure but sort of dead end engineer job, and I blagged my way into a sales job with no experience selling hotel locks of all things. Didn't have a clue how to sell it really, but started to sell it because I had some, I guess, selling ability, and I learned a lot from my boss there, because he was, you know, a salesman, and he had all these skills of how to bring a business from that up to that. So yeah, and it was all going rosy, and then all of a sudden, probably about 4 or 5 months into that job, he said to me, Paul, we need to go and do some sales training up in Birmingham. I booked us into the hotel. Is that all right? And I was like, no, really sorry. I've got a restaurant gig. I've got a restaurant gig. And our kind of relationship went downhill from that point onwards, where, you know, I had to not do the restaurant gig. And rightly so, I guess, really now I think about it. But it kind of put a bit of taste in my mouth. And I guess it did him as well. So I stayed at that job for about 15 months. And then... I sort of found out that I might not be coming back the after Christmas. And at the time I had a mortgage at the time. I had, you know, a car, and I didn't have any kids, luckily. But I spoke to my wife over the Christmas period and said, you know, I don't think I'm going to be in this job for much longer. What do we do? And she said, well, you're never going to get another opportunity to do what you want to do. And she goes, I know you want to have a go at being a full-time magician. She said, because what you can do is you can leave that job and go get another sales job for 3 months and it might not work, or you can write yourself a business plan for 6 months and see if it works. And that's what I did. Luckily, I was doing a lot of wedding fairs at the time. And I was pretty good at selling on the day and getting, you know, deposits. So even just the deposits from those were enough to, you know, pay the bills over the course of a month. And luckily, within a few months, I, you know, was running. We were absolutely flying. There was no looking back. And I was still very close to Spencer, who was, I guess, subbing me out on high profile jobs. And then I became very good friends with Lee Smith. And very, very quickly on, you know, we were going doing jobs in Dubai together, and I was doing all these amazing gigs for these magicians, and it was like a luxury position. I wasn't even really doing anything. They were just handing me work that they couldn't do. So it was great. And then I just needed to start learning it for myself. And naturally I started to do that. And that then started to take over the priority. So I started working less and less with Spencer and Lee. I worked the circuit for a few years, and then the next big kind of break, I guess, came when I saw a great magician. He's actually very, very popular nowadays. He always has been, but people know him a lot more nowadays. And it's a guy called Matt Daniel Baker.
Yeah,
you will have heard of Matt Daniel Baker now. He's got, you know, he's got his own sort of West End show in a venue, and he's very, very much on that cabaret circuit now. Sorry, losing my voice. And we were doing a corporate job together somewhere in Surrey, and we were both working a job, and we didn't know each other, but I was performing to a group, and I noticed he was walking round, and he was sort of looking at me, and he said, "Yeah, guys, I'm really, really impressed with what I've just seen." Here's what it is. He goes, "I'm actually part of Keelan Laser's iPad team called the Digital Illusionists," and he goes, "We're always on the lookout for magicians who can, you know, do a surplus of work for us of iPad magic. When we're sort of traveling, we can't do it." So he said, "Do you mind if I put you in touch with Keelan?" And over the course of a couple of months, nothing happened. And then eventually I saw Keelan at a trade show, and we became very good friends. And again, I got given the keys to the kingdom. It was like Keelan just went, "Do you fancy going to India tomorrow? All right, here's an iPad. Here's some custom magic I need you to learn on the plane over there. Go and shine." And it was amazing. And for 18 months, I'd literally just traveled the world for Keelan, pretty much. Lots of planes, lots of hotels, lots of incredible venues and companies doing, you know, iPad and digital magic. And it was, again, a strange position to kind of find yourself in when you weren't really getting the work yourself. You were just being given it. And again, after that 18 months, it was actually coming to the end of that was when COVID, kind of happened, because we're talking about the course of probably about 10 years now. So it's a bit of a period of time. And coming to the end of that was probably, I think the last time I went out to India was probably just, like I say, just before COVID happened. Mm-hmm. And that kind of then dried up for me, because then I started to do my own stuff again. Then we had the issue, didn't we, of COVID and how we're going to get through it. And luckily for me, I started doing virtual shows very early on. And it started off as just doing, you know, parties for like 18th and 21st. But I very quickly realized that there was an opportunity in the corporate market if I could find it. And luckily I did. And I, you know, went from having probably should have been the worst 2 years of magic to probably having the best 2 years of magic, because I didn't need to leave the house, which you know, I didn't have any expenses. I think the first December of COVID, which would have been December 2020, I think I did about 106 virtual shows in less than 3 weeks. It was that busy, where they were just lined up one after another. Like, you know, at one point I was doing like 10 to 15 shows a day back to back. It was crazy. And it was back at that time, you could name your price as well. You know, there was no industry standard for being a virtual magician, because nobody had done it before. So yes, some magicians went in low, some went in high, some went in the middle. And it was all about finding a place, because you could literally say it's this much and a client wouldn't have anything to base it on. So it was an interesting time. And luckily a good one. But throughout that time, because of what I just said, that there wasn't really an industry specific thing you could do. There weren't tricks that were put out. It wasn't like, you know, you could see, I know, Craig Petty at a close-up gig doing those a lot of tricks and then go, "Do you know what, I'm going to replicate that," because there wasn't that with virtual work. So you had to kind of create your own stuff very, very quickly and fail, because a lot of it just didn't work online. And then over the course of, you know, months, you would learn what did work. So what that did was it taught me to kind of create something. It taught me to create a show where I could literally, and it was the first time it ever happened, where I knew my show so well. And weirdly, I did one a couple of days ago, and it was like I got straight back into it. But I did my show so many times and so and I knew my show so well that I could play around with it. That, you know, everything was so slick. You know, I could pretty much engineer every joke that I wanted an audience to say, because I knew exactly what other people had said at what periods throughout the show. And it was I'd never had that before, but it was a great feeling. And then when COVID ended, I kind of felt a little bit disappointed that creative spell was going, and I was going to be back out, you know, gigging in the real world. And I'd had a lot of ideas over the years, but for confidence reasons, I didn't really feel like, you know, I didn't feel confident enough in magic world to release material, or I'd sent ideas in before to you know, magic dealers, and they'd not been interested. So that does not get confidence as well. And I just hadn't done anything with it before. So I decided that I was going to get a trick released in 2022, which would have been last year. That was my goal, right? It was, I want to get a trick released. I've got all of these ideas. Surely one of them, you know, because as you know, Craig, as a creator, maybe not so much nowadays for you, because your tricks are all hits now. But for us mere mortals, you know, we you know, it's kind of that iceberg principle. And even now I'm getting people like contact me saying, you know, how to get a trick released with, you know, Alakazam. And there's no really easy answer to that. Is that I could send in 10 ideas and 10 of those could get rejected. And then I could send in 5 ideas and then one of those might get accepted, you know? So it's, you just never know. I think now that I've been creating for a little while, that you start to get an idea of, you know, the sort of dealers that would like a particular trick, or you learn the skills of a particular dealer, so you know potentially which to offer it to. But yeah, so sorry, I completely went off on a tangent then, didn't I? So
this is fascinating. I'm loving every second of this.
So yeah, I went back out in the real world and I was like, I'm gonna release something. And I'd had the idea for Overdraft, you know, years before, and I'd had the idea for Transaction, but again, I'd never kind of done anything with these ideas. Also, I think thinking back, I had things like Kit, still got kids luckily, but I've got my kids, I've got a mortgage and cars, and all that sort of thing. I kind of suppressed that side of me because I felt I needed to earn money to pay the bills, and obviously I still do, so I didn't let that side of me shine. So I made it a bit of a kind of internal target, and that was, number one, to get my business back to where it was pre-COVID, without the virtual gigs obviously, and number two, to actually release some magic and spend some more time in the magic world. And within about a week of that, I had D. Christopher taking on what became Overdraft, and yeah, that's kind of where it's gone. And then I've just got a bit more confident with the creating side of it over the last year, I guess, now or so. You know, some tricks aren't for some people. I know that. I create magic for me. And I think that's hopefully what people will see when they see my releases, is that even if it doesn't fool you, I'm not creating a puzzle for a magician. That's not what I'm doing. I'm creating magic that is going to definitely work in the real world, because I don't want to, the reason I create it is because, as I joked earlier, when you're performing those 5 tricks over and over again at a gig, you become bored, you become complacent. And I've suffered that. I've literally gone and done gigs over the years where I felt like I'm on autopilot and like I'm not even present in the room, you know, because I'm just, and I've joked about this with other people as well, where you can literally go, I could have literally gone to a gig, and I did, and I would have done Extreme Burn and Card to Wallet for 3 hours, a corporate walk around, and never have to deviate away from it. And I didn't want to be that person. I wanted to actually always enjoy what I was doing. So now I create magic for myself, and I can then perform that at gigs to fill that void, that stop that complacency. And yeah, just so happens that some of those tricks that I put out, I don't put everything out, some things I keep for me, but some of those tricks, you know, people are enjoying.
That's amazing. I've got lots of questions. That was fascinating, because I don't know you that well, and I learned a lot about you from all of that. But I have questions. I have lots of questions. I was listening, and I've got lots of questions. So the first question I've got is, Can you give any advice on becoming going pro? That's a question I get on this channel all the time. I'm a semi-professional. I go out and gig occasionally. I've got a residency, whatever it may be, but I hate my job. I want to go and go pro. Now, from what you said in that situation, your hand was kind of forced in a way. You could have gone and got another sales job if you wanted to, but because I hear advice a lot from people and they go, oh, make sure that you've got X amount of bookings in that replicates the income that you've got from your job. Make sure that you've saved up this and that and the other. It doesn't sound like you did that. It was kind of a case of, fuck it, let's just give it a go and see what happens. Like, was that the case? And do you have any advice for people that are wanting to follow their dream like you did?
So I do have some advice, and it kind of stems back. Sometimes when I used to go to lectures when I was younger, right, it wasn't the tricks I would actually take away. It was like a little nugget of information. And that, weirdly, I didn't really put two and two together until just now, but it was actually something that I heard at LADS, and which would have been something you would have been involved in years and years ago, right? The LADS convention. It was when Garrett Thomas was there. And he made this, I don't know how long ago that was, but it would have been some time ago, right?
I had hair, no tattoos, and I was a lot thinner. That's how long ago that was.
But I remember him saying something, and it stuck with me ever since. And it was along the lines, not an exact terminology, of if you're going to be a magician, be a magician. Don't be an electrician, don't be a builder, be a magician, all right? And at the time, that infuriated me because I was an electrician, an engineer doing tricks on the side. But when I went away and thought about what he actually meant was, what I took from, because at the time I wasn't performing, own that being a magician, right? Own the fact that you want to be a magician. So first of all, own the fact you want to be a magician. It's not an easy road, especially now. That's some advice I can clearly give you. It's a lot harder now, I think, post-COVID. But the best advice I think I can give anybody is that I think you need to have jobs before becoming a professional magician. And the reason that being is you're going to learn skills of how to deal with different characters of people, because at different gigs, you're going to deal with different characters, different temperaments of people. But not only that is you, if you hate your job or your jobs before that, you know what you are going to have to go back to if this doesn't work out. All right. So that has to be your biggest incentive, because if it doesn't work out, if you don't put enough effort into it, or and that unfortunately is the case. Right. Yes, there were situations, you know, in my story where gigs kind of fell in my lap. But those I had to put the work in. I had to, you know, travel around the world. I was doing like 3-4 countries a week at one point. You know, this was tiring stuff. But you need to. You need to know a little bit about the world with magic, because what it does is it eliminates the awkwardness of when you're at gigs. Because I think some of my success of being a full-time magician is that I've worked in an engineering role. I've worked in kind of a sales. So I've been dealing with like business people as well. And some of that's, you know, gone to the high end. So some of the gigs I've done over the years have been, you know, pub gigs, for, you know, John the Builder, who every other word is a swear word. I've done a job for Tiffany and Company, and, you know, in Bond Street in London, where you wouldn't hear anything like that. Okay. And if anything came out of your mouth like that, you'd probably be asked to leave immediately. And as a magician professionally, you need to be able to mirror the people you're performing to. All right. So, and what I mean by that is, I don't play it safe necessarily when I'm at a gig, but if I'm at a hen do, for instance, or if I'm at a gig where people are being a bit, you know, effing and blinding and swearing, then I'll relax a little bit because I want to fit in with those people a little bit more. But I'm not going to let that be who I am all the time. I'm going to change kind of the way I perform slightly, not the tricks, but the how I perform, depending on the type of person that I'm performing for. And I think that's important, especially if you want to do this for a living, because that is how you connect with people. And another bit of advice for you is, maybe you agree with this, Craig, maybe you don't, but I always think you should dress how your audience is dressing as well. So, and the reason I say that, I'll clarify that in a minute, but what I mean is, if they're wearing kind of casual suits, then you wear a casual suit as well. If they're a bit more casual, if they're a bit more formal, like black tie, then you wear black tie. And the reason I say that is one of the first professional gigs I did was in a pub, and everyone was in shorts and t-shirts, and I turned up in a three-piece suit, and I looked like an absolute idiot. And not just that, but nobody could connect with me because I wasn't on their level, because I was this guy in this suit and I just stood out like a sore thumb, and I was doing magic. So when I perform magic, my kind of whole act, I guess, is that I'm your mate, but I've got something incredible to show you. I've got like this weird skill. And I find that gets me in, connects with audiences that, most types of audiences. So yeah, I don't know. Was that some advice?
Yeah, no, that definitely answers the question. And did you mentioned when you went pro, you talked about, hey, I'm going to put together a business plan. Yeah. Did you do that? Because I find a lot of magicians, when they go pro, their business plan is, I'm going to go pro and hopefully book some gigs in. That's my business plan. Like, how important is it to actually have targets and analytics and a plan of what you're trying to hit? Because it sounds to me like, listening to your story, you'd given yourself 6 months. Yeah. So you're like, hey, if this doesn't work after a period of time, I'm gonna
get out. Yeah, exactly. Because I'm gonna run out of money. Like I say, I wouldn't say I had a business plan, like, something from The Apprentice or anything like that. It was. I probably still got it somewhere, but it was maybe 3 or 4 pages long, and it was just a month by month, week by week thing of what I was going to do to get gigs in. And I won't lie, I've heard these things, but when you go full time, right, it's like something. When I went full time, and I've heard this from other people as well, is it's like the rule of attraction thing, okay, which is like a book I think you can read, and a theory on it, but all these opportunities started happening that just wouldn't normally happen. Like, I remember being about 2 weeks into being a full-time pro, and I was doing, I probably had maybe 4 gigs in the month. So it wasn't good. It wasn't good, it wasn't a good start. But I was proud. I was, I had to go a long way to get to that point. And I remember laying on the sofa watching a film, and all of a sudden getting a text on my phone at like 10:30 at night. Hi, Paul, this is so-and-so. I've been given your details by someone that's met you before. We're hosting this these fun days. Are you available for 14 days in a week's time? And I was like, what? And I was like, what? He's just offered me 14 days. He goes, by the way, if you can put together a show for us, that would be great. Actually, no, sorry. The first one, they just wanted me to entertain like queue lines at like this summer sort of family event. Just going up and down the queue. And I was like, yeah, I can do all those dates because I don't have a job anymore. Right. So and that kind of just came out of nowhere. And then I sold on to the fact that, how about I do like a family like cabaret style show for you? And that was how I engineered that, was then how I learned how to do cabaret. And I now do, cabaret at like Arthur in a corporate on a much higher scale. But all because I kind of then kept that contact going and then offered them a show and that type of thing. So there were certain situations which helped me out. And again, Spencer was great in those days because he was someone I could call and speak to every day if I was, struggling, because it's the mental side, of that as well. I'd gone from having a very boring but secure job. Well, not the last one, as you've just been told, but yes, that hand was forced. But I can't tell the pride I had when I walked in after the Christmas, and I decided that I was going to hand in my notice, and I walked into that office and I went, I'm leaving. And I went, really? Where are you going? I was like, I'm not. I'm leaving to be a magician. And he just kind of looked at me and just say, right, okay. And he says, do you want to work at your notice? And I went, yeah, I do. I was like, I want to work my notice because I'm leaving to work for me. So I literally spent the next 4 weeks doing nothing and getting paid for it, which was brilliant. And and I was able to get a jump start on things like emails and that then. So that helped. So it was forced. But like you said, I could have easily gone and got another job, and probably that would have been the the normal thing to do, you know. But I just thought, yeah, like you say, fuck it, let's have a go. I want to do this, and thankfully, my gamble paid off. Sometimes you've got to roll the dice, all right. Yeah. But you've got to know when to get out as well. That's important. So yeah,
that's really good advice. Really good advice. And you mentioned that obviously you're working with Keelan on the iPad stuff, and, yeah. and that kind of came to an end just as COVID hit. And then you mentioned, you know, your goal after COVID was to get your business back up to where it was pre-COVID.
Yeah.
Did you ever consider going back and doing that again? Was that no longer an option? Did you leave that sort of area, not because of COVID, but because of other reasons? You know, did it tie in with having a family and not wanting to travel around the world? Like, that's kind of like a really cushy job, you know, in terms of, I know you're not getting your own work, but it's a very high profile thing. Was there a reason why you kind of just moved more in a different direction after COVID finished?
Yeah, so my kids were born just before COVID. So I remember going to India for Keelan when my wife was pregnant. And I've got twin daughters who are four next week, believe it or not. But you know, as with any pregnancy, you know, twin pregnancies aren't easy. And my wife is heavily pregnant, and having to go to India while I'm being pregnant wasn't probably the best thing to do, because I wouldn't have been able to get back in time had, you know, there been any, you know, complications or anything. But I still had to, you know, make money. And Keelan also had moved to, or he was in the process, I forget the exact time, but he was moving to Vegas, and he now lives out in Vegas, and he's doing amazing things out there now. So I naturally knew that was probably going to come to an end, because his kind of direction was to then start what he was doing more in Vegas and concentrate on it out there. And I did enjoy traveling, but I did it. And when I had kids, I didn't want to do it again, because, and when I said I don't want to do it again, I do still do some of it, but it was just the volume of it that I was doing at one point, you know, like I say, where I think in 1 week I flew to India on a Monday. I did an event in India on the Tuesday, flew home on the Wednesday. On the Thursday, I did an event in London. And on Friday, I flew back to Mumbai in India and did an event on Saturday. And that was like my week. So even before I had kids, if it were a week like that, you know, I just wouldn't see anybody. It was like that. So having kids, there was kind of no way that I could, you know, maintain that lifestyle. So I knew I had to change. So yeah, I've had to make some changes definitely since having kids, because you know, the life of being a performer is very difficult and challenging with a family, especially when, you know, my daughter's about to start school, and you know, predominantly our work would be at weekends. So you have to really kind of find a way and work around that and get that balance, which I'm still trying to find, really.
Well, you seem to be doing really well. And where, you know, you mentioned one other thing, and I think this is something worth talking about, because I've spoken to a lot of magicians, both on here and socially. And there's a lot of magicians out there since COVID that are struggling a little bit. And you mentioned offhand earlier on that, hey, it's a little bit harder to get gigs now than it was before COVID.
Yeah.
But I also know that you're doing really well. I also know that, you know, because of the experience that you have with marketing and sales and so on and so forth, you know, I suppose the question I've got is, if there's any magicians watching this that are full time that are finding that it's a little bit of a struggle post COVID, have you got any advice? Have you found that as well? And is there any advice in terms of that side of things from a business point of view? I suppose, without making this a 3-hour masterclass on business, any sort of like business, you know, if you were going to share one business tip, is there anything you could suggest?
You've got to find out what you want to be doing as a magician. What do you want to do? So if you enjoy weddings, then actually, in honesty, weddings is a fantastic avenue to go down at the moment, because weddings are you know, at an all-time high because of COVID. So then you need to concentrate on weddings. You know, maybe you need to niche down on that a little bit more. For me, I'm trying to work because of the kids, you know, the least amount of weekends as possible. So weddings aren't really an avenue that I can really go down as much anymore. So for me, it's more corporate. But what I've done over the last 6 months is really kind of rebrand myself within the corporate and kind of almost, it's still there, but I don't promote to weddings anymore because I want to be seen as a corporate magician, because that's the type of work that I'm trying to attract. If I'm you know, going to be the all singing, all dancing, all magicking corporate guy, yet all my marketing is to do with weddings and pictures of weddings, then I'm probably not going to get those high profile jobs. So of course you can go through and just try and get every, you know, possible gig possible, you know, out there. But if it's not working, sometimes you have to relook at what you're doing, look at your own, you know, website, what maybe needs freshening up. Maybe your marketing, your social media needs freshening up, or maybe you need to. A lot of the time it's not about the tricks, right? And that's the thing. A lot of magicians get caught up on the tricks. Yes, you've got to have an act that works, but ultimately, when you're booked, as long as you've got good magic, you know, that's fine. So it's really about who you are, and you need to maybe niche down in an area that you want to. If you notice you're getting more bookings on the party side, let's say you've, I don't know, if you use a CRM or something, I do, if you use a CRM and you're finding that you're getting more work for 18th, 21st parties, then promote for those, you know, because there's something going on there maybe within your own marketing. So you might need to niche to find them a little bit. I guess I don't know, that would kind of be the advice. That's what I've done anyway with the corporate side of stuff.
That's great. And on that subject, obviously creating magic is a second income stream. Let's talk about creation for a little bit. You mentioned when you were chatting that you got turned down before you actually had your first release come out through the 1914.
Yeah.
I suppose there's a lot of people watching this that want to be a creator in magic. And I know from speaking to a lot of people that what's happened to a lot of people is they've pitched a product to a company, they've said no, and they've been completely disheartened. How, you know, like your first release was the 1914, which is an incredible company. And, you know, Overdraft is one of my favorite tricks of all time. I think it's absolutely amazing. It's in my wallet. It stays in my wallet. It's brilliant. What I'm trying to say is, what process did you go through to get to that? What made you choose 1914? And like, had you, you know, the stuff that you'd pitched beforehand, what made you decide to go into the creating side of things and actually releasing your tricks to magicians? And how did you overcome that kind of negativity of people not getting back to you when you pitch them a product?
Yeah, number one, I think that, as I said, I think briefly earlier, is that, you know, when people think you release magic, for us mere mortal creators, they think you just send a trick in and someone says yes straight away. And I wish that was true, but it doesn't. With the 1914, they had a couple of releases out, and I just loved kind of their packaging, the way things were shot, everything about them. And I knew maybe like I knew that at an inkling they were a newer company, so were looking for more artists. So I kind of thought that I'd have a good shot with those guys. So I took a product idea to them, pitched it to them, and they said yes. And then they said, "Have you got anything else?" D said, "Have you got anything else?" And I sent the email in, and 5 minutes later, it was like, "Yeah, that's the one we want to release. That's the one we want to release first." And that was what became Overdraft. But again, I think it's a fit for dealers as well. I've been doing this a little bit now, nowhere near as long as you have, Craig, in regards to creating, but you get a feel for the type of product or where a product might place better. All right, so there's nothing in this, but for instance, you might create a card trick and you might go, actually that'll be really good for an Alakazam release. I could see Alakazam releasing that. So there's a little bit of a strategy in the thinking is that I do, especially. So when I'm creating or when I've created something, and I want to give myself the best possible chance of, you know, getting a trick released, because otherwise, you know, it's an idea that I'll keep. And funny enough, a lot of my ideas I'll continue to work on, and you know, maybe they're not right at that point, but maybe they will in the future. But it's still very tough when someone says no. But you do have to have a little bit of a thick skin with it, all right? Because a dealer isn't looking at, you know, necessarily you know, Joe blogs releasing them. They're looking, is it the marketability of it? Is it commercial? Because they're the ones that you're not self-releasing, that they're investing their time and money in you. And Christopher sort of put it really into perspective for me a while ago. He told me all about that side of it, and he said that, you know, it's very difficult for a dealer to invest in an unknown creator, especially these days, because it's the unknown. And when you get that first release out, D said to me, he goes, the door's open now, it'll be much easier. And, you know, he was absolutely right, because now people don't know I am necessarily, but my name's out there a little bit, more. And people, I can say when I send a product in, oh, by the way, I'm Paul Fowler. Check out some of my releases. Here's a link to Overdraft. Here's a list transaction and footwear. So I've kind of got a bit of a start in run up now, so to speak. But all I'll say to people that want to create something is just keep going, keep banging on that door. I must have sent in maybe 10 ideas over the last maybe 4 or 5 years to Alakazam, and I just kept banging on that door. And I remember when Pete and Artie said yes to the first one, I said, I told you I'll keep banging on that door until you say yes. And we laughed about it, but yeah, you just got to keep going. You have to keep going. If that's what you want to do, then find a way. Just as if you want to be a magician that's doing 5-6 gigs a week, find a way. You know, there you can take the advice I give you. You can take, you know, your advice, Craig, any advice that you've given in the past, but ultimately that person's got to walk that line and, you know, find a way.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Really true and really good advice. Do you find now that doors are opening to you more, like in terms of, like you say, you've had Transaction come out, incredible release, you know, very, very popular. You've had Overdraft come out, really, really popular, incredible release. As far as I can tell from footwear, I know it's only just come out, but that seems to be very well received as well. Like, do you find now that, like, you're not facing an uphill battle anymore? It's kind of a case of, you know, they're more likely to go, yeah, absolutely. Because you are a sellable commodity. You've got people know who you are. You've got a proven track record.
Yeah. Certainly, like I say, it's a little bit easier to get into those conversations now, because you start to build a relationship with, like, you know, I've built a relationship with Pete and Ardy and the team at Alakazam now. I've built a relationship with Saturn Magic, Mark and Mark. You know, I've built a relationship with D and Jack at 1914. And I'm building a relationship currently with, you know, Sean and the guys at Penguin. But certainly has got me more conversations and got me to the right people now, because I, you know, people already might know of my releases, whereas before I wouldn't necessarily know who to talk to or what to do, or even getting those conversations. Or if I message that person online, I find that they're more inclined to offer like a video call to, you know, to have a little look at the releases, whereas before they might have been like, just, you know, put a submission through the website, which you have to do in the early days. But you always worry as a creator that, are they actually looking at it, you know, or they don't like it, you know, off it goes. But so yeah, there's certainly more doors open now. And, you know, just the amount of people I've, you know, connected with in magic, even people like yourself, just because I've had footwear's my fourth release.
I must be missing one then. I got.
Yeah, no, I had a download out with Alakazam last year. Resemblance, which is a bit more, is a bit underground. So, but if you go to Alakazam and you type in Paul Fowler, you'll see it come up. So, so three kind of physical products, one download so far. But yeah, just the connections I've made so far in the magic industry, just from those four releases in under a year, I guess, is you know, mind blowing. Even now when I think about it.
And you know, you talk about being a business person and spending a lot of time developing your performing side of things.
Yeah.
Do you spend time creating? Is that an important part of your business now? Are you sitting there thinking, you know, right, okay, I'm going to start creating something else. I'm going to go through that creative process. Or is it more of a case of I'm a magician, but, you know, when I've got an idea, I'm going to nurture it, I'm going to create it, but I'm not going to force that. It's not a big part of what I do.
Yeah, that's a really great question, actually. It's really, as you all know, it's highly addictive when you release a trick, okay? Mm-hmm. Because the kind of everything that comes with it is like you just want that, right? But then you have to understand that very quickly that the trick has to be good and well received for it to feel like that anyway, because very quickly, you know, if it's not liked, unfortunately mine have, you know, been liked at the moment, but it could easily go the other way. So I don't force creativity. I've tried to on numerous occasions and it just doesn't work. I actually find that when I tend to create more, and for my creative process is I tend to get inspiration from things I see in shops and stuff like that, or when I'm out and about and I just sort of see something, I think, oh, that, you know, that'd be good. That'd be a good thing to create magic with. Or I go into like a deep thought. I remember driving home from Blackpool, last Blackpool just gone. And it's like a 5-hour drive for me. And I didn't listen to the radio at all on the way home, right? No music. I was just in my own head creating magic because I was in this like deep kind of creative state where ideas were flowing. I also find one of the best times when I have good ideas when I'm really pissed off as well. I don't know why that is, but I'm kind of like, I'm really angry about something or really annoyed. And I'm just like, yeah, fuck it. And then all of a sudden, all these ideas come into my head. So if maybe I should just get someone to wind me up constantly and I'd come up with lots of ideas. Yeah,
well, that's all being married, isn't it, mate?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, you can't force it. You can try and force it, but it's really hard and you have to. I actually think one of the best advices I could give, best pieces of advice I give somebody who wants to create some magic, but always create for yourself, by the way, always create for yourself. If it so happens that also would make a good product, then that's brilliant as well. But create for yourself because it's you then. And that's how you add who you are to what you're doing. But what you should do, and this is what I used to do, is I used to look at my gig bag, used to open it up at gigs. And when I was feeling complacent because I was performing the same tricks over and over again, I'd go, wouldn't that trick be cool if I could do it with that? Right. Wouldn't that trick be cool? That's a trick I love performing. I know at the back of my hand. But what if I, you know, took away the card box and then added that in? Or what if I'd stopped doing Jay Noblezada's 5-1 switch and I started and I had some credit cards made that had that method on? You know, what if I got rid of Marvel book test for a moment and built something into some receipts that I, you know, so what I started to do is like ideas that I, or tricks that I was already doing, I thought, how can I make them my own and take those plots and kind of spin them on their head, but to make them my own, because I think that's probably the easiest way to do it for somebody that wants to create magic. If you like doing ring flight and you love ring flight, it's like your calling. We'll find a way to do ring flight that's different. You know, that's the simple way of doing it. Maybe get rid of the ring and do something else, or you know, don't have it go to a set of car keys. Have it go I don't even know. They've all been done now, haven't they, really? But Craig, we'll end up creating a new ring flight now. What,
I think we're going to roll it live right here on this interview.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good tool, actually. Look at what you've got in your close-up bag and go, I really like that. Like, because some of the stuff, I love Stand Up Monty. And although it's not a releasable product, instead of doing it the way everybody else does it, you know, I thought, it'd be cool if I could do this and change these gags up and have some different cards printed, and then I'm performing essentially the same method but my own version of it. So I just made it my own, and I still do create a lot of magic for me. So some things I keep for me, and then some things I want to share with the magic world.
That's cool. That's really cool. That's great. So what have you got coming up in terms of releases? So obviously we've had the four that we talked about. You just name dropped Penguin, and you said you're building a relationship up with Sean. So are we going to be seeing Paul Fowler releasing something in the future with Penguin Magic?
Yes,
I've got the biggest magic shop in the world. I mean, it is like the thing. When I started working with Penguin, I was like, okay, this is cool.
Yeah, it's weird because Penguin was one of the kind was, you know, I remember buying On the Spot with Greg Wilson and Liquid Metal when I was like, you know, when I very first got into magic, and they were Penguin releases. So yeah, I've got something coming out of Penguin in probably the next few months, hopefully. Just waiting on a bit more info from that. I've also got another trick Pete and Artie has bought the rights off me for. I don't know when that will be out. I've got a few other things of 1914 as well, but we've not started working on, you know, prototypes yet. So I'm all right. But the plan is to start lecturing. My lecture is ready, so I'm going to start lecturing early next year. That is the plan. And I've got, if you like my stuff so far, I think you'd really like my stuff in the lecture. But of course, my latest release is footwear with Alakazam. And
best way I could describe that trick is it's just fun.
It is, and it's, you know, it's quirky, it's fun. And when I created it, I'm not sure it's actually for me in terms of but I always thought to myself, if I was ever going to do something like BGT or something like that, and I don't think I ever would, just because, like I say, it's not really something I'm personally interested in doing. But I thought I'd need a trick, and when I came up with footwear, I was like, this would be a perfect trick to do on BGT, right? Because it's so easy, it's quirky, it's funny, and there's no sleight of hand involved. So I could literally just go and do it and not have to worry, and then, you know, obviously do some other stuff with it. But there it is. So yeah, it's just a fun trick, and I love it because it's not an everyday carry, it's an everyday wear. I remember Colin McLeod saying at one point, he was talking about his Superman thing he did on the Raw Variety Show, and he spoke about he wanted to become the prediction, and that's essentially what I wanted to do with this. I wanted to become the prediction, and, you know, always have it on you, or have it on me. So and that's what we create with footwear. And then and you'll know this being a creator, that was kind of the end goal, right, of having what the sock part of the trick is. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I could do this? And that became a card to impossible location as well. And then when I realized I didn't need to do any other work to do that, I kind of had these kind of like butterflies in my stomach, because I was like, oh, that, you know, that really works. All I have to do is get a card chosen and the trick's done. That is literally it. The card is chosen. I hand the deck to the spectator, and the trick's over. Yeah, and that became footwear.
That's great. That's brilliant. Yeah, and it's so good. And I can't. And outside of Alakazam and Penguin, is there something else that you're working on at some point down? Are you constantly kind of tinkering with ideas in your head?
I have. I've got your idea. I'm looking at it right now. Your idea was to have a creativity board that you said in an earlier
episode. I swear, but I'm looking at it right now.
I've got about 9 ideas on there. Weirdly, I haven't updated in a while. I've got footwear's actually on there, and I've got a couple other things on there that have that are in the pipeline to be released in the future. But on my phone, I've got whenever I have an idea, I'll write it down as a note on my phone, and then I'll revisit them. And there are a few things that, you know, have come up with a lot of ideas over the course of the last few months. There's a couple of things that I think I've got good traction that I need to kind of work on, but haven't created any prototypes from yet. I've ordered parts to do that. But yeah, just with like family life and gigging and with the release of footwear, it's just finding time, right? Time is just the biggest currency, and it's in high demand at the moment in my life, at least with my girls and my wife. So yeah,
perfect. And I got two more questions for you. And the first question is, obviously you've released all of this magic. Are you going to be lecturing at some point? Because honestly, with your experience, both in terms of as a performer and a creator, you know, you could have an amazing lecture on commercial close-up magic, you know, all of the stuff that you've done, maybe some business advice in there. I think that would be an amazing lecture.
Yeah. So yeah, lecture is ready to go. It's just getting to that point of, getting the bookings for it. So the plan is to do that early next year, start lecturing early next year. At which point I always wanted to have 5 tricks out before I started lecturing. Cause I don't know why, I just sounded like a good number of tricks. So when my Penguin release comes out, that will be trick number 5. And yeah, then the lectures will be kind of, you know, my priority for a while, at least to start showing a lot of magic. Because I've got a lot of stuff that I've created that isn't necessarily isn't commercial enough to release as a product, but is definitely commercial enough for a magician to perform and want to perform, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I've got a lot of material like that that is in the lecture. So I'll hopefully start sharing that with people early next year.
That's amazing. That's great. And the last question.
Yeah.
What's next? Is there anything on your magical bucket list that you haven't achieved that you want to achieve? Because let's be honest, like you say, your mid-30s, you've achieved so much. And I speak about this a lot on this channel, you personify this in that if I spoke to the average magician and said to them at the end of their career, if you could have achieved what you've achieved right now, they'd be happy. You've traveled the world performing magic, which is everyone's goal. You've made a living doing what you love and support, you know, you're paying your bills, your mortgage, bringing up a family, doing something that you love. Not only that, you've released best-selling tricks with some of the biggest companies in the world. You've become very well known as a creator, as an innovator. You know, you've worked with some of the best outside of creativity. You know, you've name-dropped Spencer Wood, you've name-dropped Keenan, you've name-dropped Lee Smith. All of these are juggernauts in our industry. And you've done all of that, and you're mid-30s. I mean, wow, seriously, dude. I mean, you've done so much. Is there anything left where you go, you know what? Because I can also tell that you're quite a goal-driven person as well. Yeah. So what's in your magical bucket list that you haven't done that you want to do?
So I always have this kind of, I've said this to my wife before. So that my goal is, you know, in my you know, late 40s, early 50s, or as soon as possible, really, is when the kids are, you know, grown up a little bit more, and you know, they're off doing their own thing. But this is kind of a bit more of a long-term goal, I guess, is that my ideal gig in the future would be to drive to a hotel somewhere in the UK, right? My wife come with me, so we get to, you know, go to a hotel and, you know, have and enjoy that, actually what she doesn't get to enjoy a lot of the time, a nice venue, right, that I get to go to a lot. So she'll come to the hotel, get a free night stay over and a nice meal and that type of thing. And I'll go and do a sound check at 4 o'clock for a cabaret show, hang out with her in a spa or whatever, then go on stage at 9 for a 30-minute cabaret, and then that's it, go home after the next day, right? And then do that a couple of times a week. That would be the ideal, like, career in magic in the future. But at the moment, my big goals of what's next are continuing to become, I guess, a big name on the corporate circuit. And what I mean by that is, you know, I want to be like your David Mead, your Luca Volpes, and that sort of people, the people that do all these conferences, and they're like the go-to people within the corporate side of stuff. And the other thing I've been working on a lot recently is having a cabaret corporate act as well. So I've put a lot of time and investment into, you know, showreel and doing that. So I've got a lot more, you know, big cabaret shows lined up this year, like at the Grosvenor in London, and yeah, and it's all a learning curve, you know, because, you know, a cabaret, a mini cabaret at a wedding, which I used to do a lot of, is very different to a cabaret after dinner for you know, 300-400 corporate suits who are all drunk and don't really want to be there, you know. So it's all a learning curve. But yeah, that's kind of where my goals are now, is that, like I say, I don't really want to work weekends. Do you know what? And it's not my fault. It's Paul Brook's fault for that, because years ago I met Paul Brook at a trade show, and he said to me, he goes, the best decision I ever made, Paul. He was talking to me. Paul was obviously talking to Paul, but he said, the best decision I made, Paul, he goes, is I've taken December off for the last, you know, 5 years of the family. And I looked at him, and at the time I was like, isn't that the highest earning month? And he went, no, because of the way my business is. He goes, I get to take the entire December off. So he kind of planted that seed in my mind. And I started doing the whole weekend thing a while ago, where I don't work weekends. And although I do work some, I work a lot less. And I think I've made a good choice, especially because of the time that gives me back with my family. So yeah, the goal is to more corporate, more cabaret, and to get a balance, you know, more of a balance with family.
That's great. That's really cool. Yep. Nothing more important than family. Nothing more important than family. That's fantastic. That's genuinely fantastic. Now, here's a question. If anybody wants to buy any of your tricks directly, do you have a website for your own stuff, or do people get it from magic shops? Like, how can, if somebody's listening to this and hasn't heard of you and they're like, you know what, I want that and that, can they reach out to you, or is there a place to?
Yeah, they can do. Yeah, really, I should have thought about that, shouldn't I? I should have set up like in fact, Craig, before it, yeah, me and you should close this down right now and set up a shop, shouldn't we? I've got some units available of all my releases at the moment, so you can contact me through Facebook or Instagram, you know, Paul Fowler Magic, or drop me an email, info@paulfowlermagic.co.uk. Let me know what you're interested in, and if I haven't got any in stock, because hopefully they will be sold out at some point, then I can definitely point you in a direction of, you know, a dealer that will have it in stock. But yeah, you can, I've got some units, so we're good for the time being.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. You know what, this has been an incredible interview, and you are very inspirational. You really are. You've achieved so much. You're a really driven person. You're making big waves in this community, and you've just come out of nowhere, and it shows that, you know, you can, you know, it's just what you've achieved is just mind blowing. It really is, in such a short period of time as well. I rarely see people come in and just kill it with their first release and continue to kill it. And that's something you've done. So seriously, congratulations, Paul. It's been a fantastic chance for me to get to know you better as well.
Yeah, thank you, mate. Thanks for having me again. Yeah, really, really pleased to, you know, be back on your channel. Well, I'm a big fan, as you well know. So, absolutely honoured, mate, to be here. And hopefully there'll be another release out at some point, and we'll talk again.
We're going to talk again, absolutely. Guys, do me a favour, leave a comment down below. Let Paul know what you think. I'm sure he'll read it. And just buy everything that this man comes up with, because it's all golden. Trust me. I'll be back again soon with another video, but thank you very much for watching. On behalf of Paul Fowler, this was Talk Magic, and we'll see you again. Thanks very much for watching, Paul, one more time. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel,
Magic TV,
which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.